know how the story of the Moors murderers Myra Hindley and Ian Brady ends. But what do we know of how it began? How did an ordinary working-class Manchester girl end up killing five children? Those who grew up alongside her, those who studied her mind, and the families of Myra's victims shed new light on her descent into darkness.
Myra's dad said to my dad, "I've made a monster, John. I've made a monster."
From their testimony, we've dramatised the events that turned her into an icon of evil, inseparable from Ian Brady.
She was very submissive to him, whether she thought she was getting the love she deserved. And that's what she thought love was. I don't know.
Myra's childhood was toughened by a lack of love.
Rather than having a soft and giving mother to kind of balance out the rather violent and domineering father, her mother was also combative.
Myra encountered death at an early age.
He was grey, he was white. I put my eyes into the coffin and I just looked away.
Hindley's unpublished autobiography reveals intimate details of her relationship with Brady.
It was clear to her from the moment that he pressed his mouth to her that he'd never kissed anyone before. He bruised her with his teeth. He hurt her.
This is the story of a love affair turned toxic, of a couple withdrawn into a secret world, of perverted and violent fantasy made reality, and of how they devised a plan for murder which would draw five children to their death. During Myra's childhood, money was short, but community spirit was strong. Born in 1942, she lived in Gorton, one of the poorest districts in Manchester. Liz Cummins, the cousin of Moore's victim Pauline Reed, lived just across the road.
It was the happiest days of my life growing up in Gorton. We had nothing, but everybody, it was like one big family.
But for Myra, for anyone on those streets, violence was there if you went looking for it. Not everyone did. Not everyone stood their ground when they found it. Not everyone grew into a child killer.
The area where Myra lived, which was near the monastery, was very small houses. You could hear everything that was said next door through the walls. They were, I suppose, what you call today slums.
It got to the stage where we were all sleeping in the same bed, the girls as well, because they started getting old. We all had to sleep in the same bed until my gran and my granddad moved out, you see. That's how close we were. Your doors were left open, kids running out of everybody's houses, and that's the way it was, because nothing got touched.
But this was post-war Manchester, and the heavy industry on which many families depended was in decline.
People did argue. I remember dads even having arguments on streets and over kids, and then the dads never spoke and the kids got friends again. It was that type of community. Myra was a little bit older than me, but in the same group of friends. Myra was probably the loudest in the group, and bold and brash.
She and her younger sister Maureen were brought up by their mother Nellie and their father Bob, just back from the war.
You would hear Nellie at the end of the street because she'd shout,
"Myra! Maureen!"
I think that's where Myra gets the loudness from.
Tea's ready!
Much of the information about Myra's childhood comes from Myra herself when she was in jail. Her accounts should be treated with caution. She was seeking to make excuses, shape public opinion, and win release from prison. She described her childhood to Duncan Staff, a journalist given exclusive access to her papers and unpublished autobiography, in which she blames her father for the way he shaped her personality.
She disliked him intensely. On the other hand, she could see herself in him. He was a tough man, a hard man. He'd fought in North Africa. And when he came home, he was working in a menial job doing manual labour. He simply wasn't able to cope with the adjustment. He dealt with this by drinking very heavily and by slapping Myra's mother around. He also hit Myra, whereas he was softer on Maureen.
They felt they couldn't really cope with Myra. For whatever reason, it may have been within Myra that the problem actually lay, or it may have been that the parents were very poor at coping.
To ease tensions, Myra, but not Maureen, was sent to live with her gran round the corner.
Myra would have seen this as the arrival of Maureen and she being rejected, pushed away.
She loved her grandmother and was very happy there, but she felt alienated in a sense from her family background and from the world which had created her.
Myra claimed her father increasingly turned to drink, often at the Steelworks Tavern, which still stands. She said tensions between her parents deepened.
He'd come back from the steelworkers, or Steely, and hit Myra's mum, Nellie, every night.
Come on, have you? Spent up, have we? Eh? How many pints this time?
Cycle!
Eight, nine, ten!
I can go out with a drink
for
the race!
Oh, you're entitled, are you? Are we entitled to eat what? Dinner?
You're going on about?
You're probably useless!
Get out of me! What are you doing?
You're leaving me! Sleep on the way!
Myra and her grandmother would wait outside and listen the sound of raised voices and the start of a fight. Then they'd dash in and Myra would try and pull Bob off Nellie while her grandmother hit her father repeatedly to try and end the fight.
Myra herself was often shouted at for her trouble.
Rather than having a soft and giving mother to kind of balance out the rather violent and domineering father, her mother was also combative.
There was one way in which Bob Hindley must have felt he was helping his daughter.
He taught her how to fight. He taught her how to do the type of thing that he himself was doing to Myra's mother.
She picks out his reaction to one street fight in particular as a turning point. She recounts in detail the exchange that followed.
Look what she's done!
Myra expected her father to protect her and stand up for her because he was this powerful figure within her life. He did the reverse.
You're gonna sort it yourself because you're a big girl now, Myra. I'll tell you what, you're gonna go out there, you're gonna leather him, or I am gonna leather you. Get out!
She was on her own, but armed with her father's fighting technique. Decades later, she could still recall the exact sequence of blows. A left to the head, a right to the stomach, a left to the temple, which led to victory.
She learned that dominating someone was an important part of establishing herself and her own self-worth.
She'd done what her father had asked of her, and he ruffled her hair. He congratulated her. He gave her approval, and this is what Myra craved.
She was rewarded by her father, who basically had created a loop within her to realise that you could influence the world outside by brutal force.
Though Myra made much of this, her father wasn't unique. Mary Smith, who grew up nearby, is the widow of the man once married to Myra's sister, Maureen.
If you came home and you'd been fighting, and the first question out of our mum's mouth would be, did you win? And if you didn't win, then you'd be sent out to go out and to win. And so you'd have to stand your ground, you'd have to do.
Myra may claim to have been toughened by the lack of love from her parents, but it would be Ian Brady who would unleash her darkest desires. He, though, was still years away, and other tragic events awaited Myra before the two would meet. As a child, Myra Hindley built a reputation as a street fighter. In her unpublished autobiography, she insists this tough background and her violent father provided an excuse for what was to come. But that doesn't wash with Mary Smith, widow of the man who was once Myra's brother-in-law.
I would find that absolutely ridiculous because then more than half, 90% of all girls and boys that was reared in that day and age should have become serial killers then, because we was all sent out to look after ourselves.
The truth, according to those who knew Myra, is that something in her personality set her apart.
She had no empathy for anybody else. If somebody hurt themselves, it wouldn't upset her or anything like that. And if anybody upset her, she'd lash out and hit them. And that's how she was.
I think She could handle herself, Myra, very much. She wasn't scared of anything or anybody.
Myra's reputation as a fighter made her a target. Other kids, often bigger, wanted to prove themselves against her. On one occasion, a boy heard she'd been treated for nits. Initially, he got the better of her. She shouted at him to break.
She recalled how he had failed to obey the street fighting rules. When he should have broken, he didn't break and continued to hit her. So she punished him for this by grabbing him by the head and slamming it repeatedly into the ground.
She was going to pummel him beyond his life's worth. There was a potential that was not restrained by emotional expression, which could point to a deficit that was always there in Myra, that coolness, that callous lack of empathy, that meant she had the potential all the way through her life to do serious damage.
Myra claimed her prowess gave her a new role on the streets.
She achieved a certain status and took upon herself the role of protector.
Often, it would be her sister Maureen she protected. With tragic irony, she did the same for Maureen's friend, Pauline Reed. But just a decade later, Myra would choose Pauline to become the first Moore's victim. If Myra was fiercer than many children, she was also brighter.
An interesting question is whether a better education would have saved Myra Hindley.
She escaped inwardly from the turbulence of her life into a world of fiction. She'd shut herself away with the children's classics of the time, Beatrix Potter and Enid Blyton, then The Secret Garden and Swallows and Amazons.
She sought something beyond, something that was beyond the ordinary life. She wanted to touch on a greater power. She tried this with religion, but she also sought in literature to go beyond the simple reality.
Myra went to Sunday school at St. Francis's Monastery nearby. She and her father wanted her to go there for her secondary education, but her mother disagreed. In the end, Myra's mother got her way. Myra was entered for the 11 plus, but recalled she had to sit the exam at a school for middle-class children in another part of Manchester. She claimed she felt overwhelmed and failed. As her mother had wished, she was sent to the local multi-faith secondary modern. Now a teenager, much in demand as a babysitter, Myra took a back seat at school, still enjoying English literature, but truanting regularly.
She wasn't a very communicative person, even at school. She didn't mix very well. It was as if she was looking for something and couldn't find it.
She tended to avoid girls and hang around with boys, including Alan Grafton.
Myra was, in my opinion, more of a tomboy than the other girls. Don't think that many of the lads at that time really took a fancy to Myra, as she was loud, she could fight. They just didn't want to get involved, I don't think. But at that particular time, Myra had this crush on one of our friends called Michael Higgins. Nice lad was Michael, and everybody liked him.
Michael, at 13, was 2 years younger than Myra. The pair were inseparable.
They was always together, very good friends. She used to take him to the park and used to take him swimming and the same initials as well, which made a difference, you know.
Myra was a strong swimmer and looked after Michael. Tragedy struck the day she decided not to go with him.
Unfortunately, Michael, on one sunny day, went to Debdale Park in Gorton, where they've got some reservoirs, and went for a swim with some friends, and Michael never come home. Apparently, the currents of that reservoir took his life.
Michael, who'd been with two other boys, had swum far out from the bank and got cramp in the deep, cold water. Police frogmen recovered his body that evening.
She was devastated about Michael's death. Everybody was devastated about him because he was a lovely lad.
She felt that she should have been there. She said she would be there. She wasn't. She would have saved him if she was there. That's the scenario.
That night, Myra climbed into bed with her gran. In a nightmare about Michael, she was diving underwater, trying to save him, grabbing his hair, but it was too short. And then she, too, was sinking, gulping lungfuls of water.
Myra describes many nightmares and almost surreal moments where she felt she was reenacting the scenario of Michael's death, as if really trying to physically place her presence at the scene and do something about it. But she also had it as an obsessive, intrusive thought, almost as something which would normal people would want to push away. But I think Myra actually saw this as a kind of vision of another world, a world in which she could perhaps almost do supernatural things.
Well, in morning, I can remember everybody knocking on people's doors saying, Michael Higgins has drowned. And Myra was very, very upset about that, because Myra, I think, in all the girls, was the closest to Michael.
Michael's body was laid out in his front room. His friends were invited in.
He was grey, he was white. I put my eyes into the coffin and I just looked away and I tried to get out of the house as soon as I could. I was that upset and shocked about seeing the body in the coffin that I've never been to see anybody else.
Myra, too, was shown the body.
She described in great and very unusual detail the sight of Michael lying in the coffin, the light falling on his face and how she could see a sliver of his eye. It's very striking, this detail, this almost obsession with death.
Michael's mother pulled the rosary beads from his fingers and handed them to her. Though Myra had blamed herself, after seeing Michael's body, her reaction to the death changed.
It became something which fired up anger, which was directed at others, not at herself. She wanted to take out her feelings, her frustrations on others. She forcefully gathered money for a wreath, often in a very threatening and menacing way, which was disturbing, considering the fact that she should have been distraught, quiet, and sorrowful. She wasn't.
One evening, she was convinced she'd seen Michael staring at her. She ran to him, but he'd vanished. Detailed and vivid descriptions of death abound in Myra's unpublished autobiography. A dog she found decapitated by a railway line. A boy she watched bleeding to death after being crushed by a lorry. A cat torn in half by two dogs.
The reason it was never published is that her supporters looked at this material. They saw that it, in fact, betrayed her. It did her damage because it showed that she was an unusual person who was familiar with and comfortable with scenes of extreme violence and death.
After Michael's death, Myra immersed herself in religion.
She became obsessed about it. She visited the church all the time. Once she'd focused on something, she'd locked onto it totally.
But her friends felt she still hadn't found what she was seeking. A new Myra emerged. She left school, took a job as a typist, and infamously dyed her hair peroxide blonde.
It was as if she was looking for love, and all I can think is that she didn't get it at home, so she tried to find it. But she wanted a male love, nothing else.
After a series of relationships, she ended up with a boy called Ronnie Sinclair. Despite Myra's reputation, he had dared to tug her hair in the cinema.
Ronnie asked her, would he marry her? And they got rings and they were engaged to be married. But Myra felt that the relationship was moving forward in a way that was expected of her, that somehow she would have to marry Ronnie, and she didn't really want that.
At home, Myra's sister Maureen also had a new boyfriend, and the dynamic of the family was changing forever. After a stroke, which left him a semi-invalid and embittered, Myra's father, Bob, was continuing to vent his frustration on Myra's mother. Maureen knew the consequences if Myra found out. Maureen's boyfriend, David Smith, would later play a pivotal role in bringing the Moors murderers to justice.
Just have a cup of tea with him or something.
Right, so he's going to listen to me.
For me? It's not my old girl, for Ed.
He didn't really want to go to the house because he didn't want to get involved with it.
In his memoirs, David Smith describes in detail the moment he witnessed the Hindley family and Myra in their true colours. David, a 15-year-old, was being asked to soothe matters before Myra got wind of what had happened. He was too late.
Davy went there just in time to see Myra enter the situation, marching in and immediately dominating the household and her father, humiliating him, stating that if he made one move again, she would not only strike him back, she would put him into hospital or even the cemetery. The intent and the dominance and the callous disregard for another human being, which includes her own parent, was already there.
You can have her!
Big man, get it!
This reversed the early childhood dominance by her father. Okay, this was in defence of her mother. However, here she was, showing the same callous regard for her own father that once upon a time he showed her.
Years later, Myra described how she was feeling trapped at this time. Age 19, she tried changing jobs and arrived for interview at a company in Gorton called Millwoods Merchandising.
That was fine, Miss Hindley. This will be your desk.
A friend had already told her of a shy, intriguing man who worked there.
When humans initially bond, we're going back to primordial times, we don't have time for long-winded introductions. In fact, we often will make immediate emotional bonding contact with someone within a split second.
Myra, this is Ian. Ian? This is Myra.
This happened Hello. With Myra Hindley when she first saw Ian Brady.
Pleased to meet you.
He was not just simply a fairly good-looking guy, but he had a strange, aloof, cool nature. One where he would be more elusive than engaging, one where he would look quite dismissive rather than interested. This drew her in.
Myra Hindley was instantly smitten with Ian Brady, and when she met her friends that night, she couldn't stop talking about him. It was Ian this, Ian that, and that went on for a very long time afterwards.
In her autobiography, she describes walking home, glancing through windows, and seeing humdrum scenes of the ordinary life she could expect if she married Ronnie. It no longer felt enough. Each step was now taking her in a new and lethal direction. When Myra Hindley arrived for her first day at Millwoods Merchandising in January 1961, she already knew what she wanted out of the job. It didn't immediately go to plan.
In her unpublished autobiography, Myra Hindley wrote she was completely smitten by Ian, but she simply couldn't understand the way he responded to her.
Thank you for your cooperation, etc., etc.
She was used to boys who, if they fancied you, they immediately told you that they fancied you. Ian held himself completely aloof.
Thank you, Miss Hindley.
Myra Hindley in later life described this as him deliberately exerting controlling behaviour because she was trying to paint a picture of herself as somebody who was being manipulated by Ian Brady from the start. I'm not sure that's right, but there's no doubt that he was cold to her.
To those who'd grown up with her in Gorton, it was clear Myra had moved on from her street fighting days. But her domineering personality remained.
She used to stand outside Millwoods, and we'd be, me and my boyfriend, my ex, my husband, would be walking down Lemonzoom Road. And even though she knew you, she'd look through you. She wouldn't acknowledge that you were there. She just had a face of, looked like marble, stone, whatever you want to call it.
To those who knew Myra, Ian, who came from Glasgow, appeared an outsider.
She probably could have thought he was handsome, but he wasn't my type. He was, and he was older than her as well. He wasn't in our circle, if you know what I mean. Most people you went around with people of your own age, not somebody a lot older than yourself.
He was very posh. He used to look very smart. I'm not saying Gorton people didn't look smart, but he was overdressed for being in Gorton.
Now, I can always remember this lad in a corner with half a bitter and a war book. And eventually, that turned out to be Ian Brady. He had a motorbike, and no kids had motorbikes. And Myra was interested in this lad on a motorbike.
Like Myra Hindley, Ian Brady came from a poor working-class background, but his background was even more difficult than Myra's. His mother was called Peggy, and she was a tea shop waitress. And she got pregnant, it's rumoured, by a newspaper reporter in Glasgow. And she wasn't able to cope with the fact she had a young child and advertised him for adoption in a newsagent's window. So like Myra, he had a sense of dislocation, a sense of rejection by his family.
Brady was fostered and from an early age began stealing, acquiring a string of convictions.
He was someone who actually gained pleasure and thrill from committing crimes as opposed to simply profit. This was something that he was going to be doing for the rest of his life.
Eventually, a court gave him a choice. Go to a young offenders institution or join his birth mother in Manchester. In 1954, Ian caught the train from Glasgow to Manchester's Victoria Station. 6 years later, he met Myra Hindley at Millwoods. She soon saw another side to the cool, aloof Ian. At lunchtime, he'd go out to place bets and would later call the bookies to get the results.
His betting name was Gorgonzola, later changed to Gorgon. And he was fine when he'd won, but when he'd lost, he just exploded.
Oh, for Christ's sake!
In these flashes of temper, Myra saw something that she was familiar with. It was the behaviour of her father. And on the one hand, it repelled her, but on the other hand, it was the familiar. It was something that she understood and knew how to deal with, so it didn't put her off him, and in an odd way, it drew her towards him.
At other moments, when he did speak, it was not to take part in banter, but to expound ideas on philosophy and literature, making clear he was apart and superior. Myra was fascinated, but Ian appeared oblivious.
It was not Ian that was actually trying to pick up on Myra or see a potential victim or a colleague here. It was Myra who pursued Ian, initially and for quite a long time.
For a time, she effectively stalked Ian, borrowing her aunt's baby son and wheeling him up and down Ian's street, but she never saw him. Eventually, she decided to show Ian she too was interested in big ideas. She went to Gorton Library and found a book of Wordsworth poetry, which she remembered from school. She recalled in detail the conversations which followed.
Wordsworth. Any good?
Marvellous, actually. Especially the long ones.
Might get a copy.
It was a blissful moment for her. This was a moment she was determined to capitalise on, and she did everything she could to make sure that once he had noticed her, he would never stop noticing her, and that she would form a relationship with him.
Do you listen to music?
Of course.
She wanted Ian more than she wanted anything.
Which?
All sorts. Bit of pop, classical, big bands, fairly Catholic, really.
Ian Brady used little things to set himself apart from his working-class background.
I prefer more crafted music, something they're recording from the TV, library.
To him, these were tremendously important things. So he didn't drink beer, he drank red wine. He didn't listen to pop, he listened to classical music.
You can borrow some spools if you like.
Technology fascinated Ian Brady. He had his own recording equipment, his own photographic kit and darkroom. Myra began saving for her own tape recorder. Years later, she described her obsession with Ian to her prison chaplain, Father Michael Teeder.
He introduced her to a different way of life. He took her, really, out of that very poor working-class background that she was growing in. He showed her other things. I think he was probably an exciting man.
She had locked her beam onto him. She had an unusual personality in that she became obsessed by things.
She called off her engagement to Ronnie Sinclair, who was distraught. He rang her daily, but she was totally focused on Brady.
In later years, she came to realise, and she wrote to me about this, that this was a critical moment in her life. Had she gone on, had she married Ronnie Sinclair, she would probably have grown up an ordinary mother in a working-class area of Manchester and led a happy life.
But it was not until the office Christmas party in December 1961, almost a year after she joined Millwoods, that Myra Hindley's relationship with Ian Brady truly ignited. He asked her to dance.
The Christmas party at Millwoods Merchandise was a hard drinking affair. They were having a party in a pub. Myra was sitting by the edge of the dance floor, feeling a little bit unsteady, and then Ian staggered towards her. He asked her if she'd like to dance and pulled her to her feet, and they lurched around the dance floor with him trampling all over her feet, but it was the happiest moment of Myra Hindley's life so far.
After the party, Ian suggested they go on for a drink. Then he walked her home.
Am I coming in?
No. My grandmother might be home.
Myra wrote in detail about her first kiss with Ian Brady. It was clear to her from the moment that he pressed his mouth to her that he'd never kissed anyone before. He bruised her with his teeth. He hurt her. This was a man who had never had any physical affection before.
You have to go.
You don't know how long I've wanted to do that.
But if Myra thought she and Ian were an item, he had other ideas. A long pattern of circling each other, playing on each other's trust, drawing the other in, began to unfold. This remained at the core of their relationship for the rest of their lives.
He wouldn't speak to her, he wouldn't recognise her in the office. And then he would suddenly come back and then pick her up again and make a fuss of her and buy her things and take her out and make her feel special. Then he would drop her and he'd do exactly the same thing again. And I think this is a grooming pattern. It's a way of gaining control over another person. And I think that that was a systematic way that he dealt with her until finally he felt that he had control over her and that she needed him.
When she did agree to have sex with Ian, the encounter was brutal. He bit her repeatedly.
Rather than it be a warm, loving moment, she described in great detail to me how violent this was, how he was rough with her. Now, she was trying to portray herself as somebody who was irresistibly drawn to a man with a dark side. But whereas most young women are confronted with a boyfriend who was violent to them when they lost their virginity, they'd end the relationship, Myra didn't.
There was something brutal about him that fascinated Myra, that actually engaged her, that resonated somewhat with her exchanges with her father, something that was feeding her need to go beyond what others would attain.
Myra's acceptance of the dark side of his personality encouraged him to reveal more. Layer by layer, Brady drew her deeper into his fantasies.
I think it was a downward spiral as far as she was concerned.
Do you know how old I was when I killed my first cat?
Go on.
10.
He changed her. He groomed her. And it's a word which probably wasn't used at the time, but I think we know the meaning of that word now.
Threw it from a tower block. Screamed all the way down.
He had a script in his head, and he needed to get her to a point where she would help him to act it out.
Didn't do that anymore, eh? Only hurt people now. It's on a higher plane.
Bit by bit, Ian revealed to Myra the books, the ideas through which his fantasies had taken shape, including the Marquis de Sade, the high priest of sadism, who preached that violence, and especially sexual violence, were justified because they were pleasurable and natural.
Do you know what I thought when I first read the Marquis de Sade?
Found your soulmate?
Ian Brady viewed dark, abnormal behaviour as something that separated him from his working-class background. So he was interested in the Marquis de Sade. He was interested in sadomasochism. This was very unusual. Now, Myra Hindley was able to enter into this world partly because she saw in Ian Brady a mirror image of her father. So where her father had beaten her from a young age, Ian Brady beat her during sex. So her childhood had, in a sense, prepared her to enter this world with Ian Brady.
They withdrew into a private world, apart from a society whose rules they increasingly scorned. But those around them caught glimpses of how their relationship was developing.
She was very submissive to him, whether she thought she was getting the love she deserved. And that's what she thought love was, I don't know. But if he told her to stand on her head, she'd stand on her head.
Maida, what do you look like here?
One summer, she was outside Shush. Millwoods and she had, you know, fancy top and the short skirt, and he didn't like Shush. It. And he made her take it off, and she took it off.
Take it off. Now.
Take it off. What, there and then?
Yeah.
In the street?
In the street.
Well, what was she left with wearing?
An underskirt, a full-length underskirt, and a bra and pants. If he said Cole was white, Cole was white. And she got on the back of the bike without the clothes on.
He gave her a book called The Carpetbaggers by Harold Robbins, which describes in graphic and sickening detail the rape of a 15-year-old girl.
Ian took from the book the notion that rape, incest and paedophilia were adventures.
If a man gets the chance to perform one of his acts, Maida, he should take it.
The couple began to play out their dreams of violence. Although Ian had previously revelled in being cruel to animals, he now decided to become their protector. The couple would read reports of people guilty of animal cruelty, then go on vigilante trips, taking revenge.
Ian could justify just being basically vicious and damaging and sadistic towards the people who were supposed perpetrators of this.
Ian would give those responsible a beating or throw a brick through a window. He and Myra were constructing a world where they did to others as they wished. With each new venture, the next step became imaginable. Many would suffer as a result. Ian Brady was a planner. To his fantasies of violent crime, he brought meticulous forethought. But he needed Myra Hindley to make his most horrific fantasies real.
This you need to read.
He found a book called Compulsion, about the real-life abduction and murder of a Chicago schoolboy by two wealthy, good-looking young men who thought they committed the perfect crime, but they were caught.
Ian Brady used the book called Compulsion by Maya Levin as a perverse blueprint for the Moores murders. The book was written as an argument against capital punishment, but Ian Brady read it completely differently. All he did was look at the mistakes that were committed by Leopold and Loeb, the murderers, in the way they carried out the killing. So they abducted somebody from close to their house. They buried them in a drainage ditch where the body would be found. When they burnt the face with acid, they didn't do it properly so the victim could still be recognised.
He saw their efforts as being futile, immature, error-ridden, and not having the great foresight that he himself thought he had.
They were seen at the abduction, left blood at the murder scene, hid the body but not properly. Idiots.
Years later, Myra described the conversation.
It's not how you do it. You plan. You need to make sure the body is never discovered.
They outlined a plan for Myra to wear a disguise and pick up a child. They'd then drive to Saddleworth Moor, where the child would be raped, murdered, and buried.
Oh, God. No. This is going to be the perfect murder. And you. You are going to help me.
They began driving around, picking out potential victims, taking photos and rehearsing what they'd do.
No
what I'd do to that. Bingo.
Myra Hindley, in her later descriptions of the run-up to the murders, painted a picture of herself being forced into the killings, of being forced to go out scouting for children. But this went on over a period of time, and it's striking that she didn't pull out, she didn't walk away.
The idea of the perfect murder became part of their sex life. As time went on, what had started as a fantasy became a real possibility. But at this point in Myra's account, she claimed she needed one final push towards murder, and that one day she got it. This is her version of what happened.
She wrote how one night she began to feel unwell. She became drowsy, and then she woke up with an appalling hangover. And it transpired that what had happened was he drugged her using her grandmother's Nembutal tablets and had then raped her and photographed her and bitten her.
That'll be the sleeping tablets.
What sleeping tablets?
Your grand's. Completely out of it, you were. Off of the fairies.
You bastard. Why did you do that?
Because you're mine. You were out cold. Because I could do whatever I wanted.
It's entirely possible she was a willing, fully awake participant in the photo session and concocted the drugging story to suggest she was at Ian's mercy. She said a few days later, he showed her the photos.
You wanna see?
What?
How you looked. When I stripped you. You were out cold.
Myra claimed she was so scared she wrote a letter to be given to the police if she disappeared. She said her body would be found in a shallow grave on Saddleworth Moor, but there's no further evidence of the letter, and she said she later retrieved and destroyed it.
There's a question as to whether that letter ever existed or not. Was it a real letter, or was it simply her trying to portray herself once again as a victim, once again as somebody who didn't really want to carry out these killings? But there's no getting away from the fact that she did carry on, she kept the relationship with Ian Brady going, and she did help carry out the Moors' murders.
The only explanation for her going through with this was that she had actually swallowed the whole idea of Ian's aims in life, that his philosophy was okay, but also that she was completely on the side of Ian and therefore safe from being a victim. It was a very scorpion-like relationship between Myra and Ian, in that, as it were, one would not particularly want to turn their back on the other in case that rather vicious and sadistic character could turn on them and they could become the victim.
The pair were now in this together. Next time, how Myra helped plan and cover up the deaths of five children with military precision. We reveal her role in the abduction, rape and murder of each child victim.
My dad said that Myra's done a murder in Attersley and there's more bodies on the moors. And my mum said, that's where our Pauline is then. And Bob said, yeah, I've made a monster. I made a monster, Maggie.
And we tell the stories of the ones that got away, including the teenager they trusted too much, who would witness their final murder and bring about their downfall. Thank you.